Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Democratic lawmakers in Wyoming have been going on a tour to hear from voters outside their communities.
I kind of want to throw all that party stuff out the window if we really could. Unfortunately, it's a system that we live in, but I think that I'm trying to cross those barriers.
Knowles turns 60 this month. The head of the Lander-based outdoor leadership school says his students' skill sets are needed now more than ever.
People who can have disagreement and actually work their way through it, and they learn those skills when you're out in a remote and austere environment.
And we'll hear about the cowboy artist who won the nation's top folk and traditional arts award.
The key feature here is it has a butterfly design sculpted into the steel itself.
Those stories and more, stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier. Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kudalska. As of July, there are almost 32,000 registered Democrats in Wyoming, compared to 212,000 Republicans. Of the 93 lawmakers in the state House and Senate, only 8 are Democrats. Lately, they've been fanning out across the state to hold town halls outside their districts. Minority floor leader Mike Yin from Jackson is one of them. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements spoke with Yin about the reasoning behind the move and the response so far.
Democratic legislators like yourself have been holding town halls in Republican districts, places like Cheyenne and Casper. What stands out to you about what people have been telling you?
A lot of people still believe in the same things that they've always believed in. For what they want their government to do. They want it to stay out of their lives, but they also want to make sure that they have good-paying jobs and the ability to have kids grow up and stay in Wyoming.
Talk to me about the philosophy behind doing these events and how they're structured. Are folks sitting in chairs facing the stage, or what's going on there?
Our events are not like most normal town halls. They're kind of in a sort of workshop style where, you know, the real goal is to center the community in a discussion of what are the things that you need us to work on, what are the things that keep you up at night, where do you want to see the future of Wyoming go, and those sort of things. I think that there are quite a few people in Wyoming who feel like they haven't been heard, and so rather than have them be talked to, we wanted to make sure that they could talk to us.
Is this a somewhat novel approach to do these town halls in places outside your own districts? Has this, in your tenure in the legislature, have you focused on this before?
As far as I know, the Democrats have not done this. I can't tell you what everyone does, but I have seen Freedom Caucus members hold some town halls, but it's not like ours. But I think that it is something that more people should do because as representatives, we don't represent just our district.
Some people have pointed out that it seems like the National Democratic Party has been struggling to mount a consistent response to the Trump administration's flurry of big policy changes. In Wyoming, the State Freedom Caucus dominates the lower chamber. Do you feel there's a parallel between developing a response to the caucus and the National Party's response to the White House? And are these town halls about developing that response?
I try to focus as much as possible on what can be accomplished in the state legislature because I actually think a lot of things that happen in D.C. are super broken, and I don't really want to repeat what happens in D.C.
Are there any strategies or thoughts that you have for implementing what people would like to see happen, given that you have 8 seats out of 93 in the legislature?
You know, a lot of it is really just figuring out what are the issues that we need to focus on, right? So, for example, in our corporations committee, we have been focusing on elections for like the past 4 years. You know what I don't hear at any of these listening sessions? None of the people that have come to a listening session has said that they want us to ban ballot drop boxes. So I think first of all, it's trying to figure out, okay, what are the issues that everyone wants to work on? And then, you know, when I can say I've been to every single community and all of them have said that they wanted strong jobs in their communities. They wanted young people to stick around in their communities. They wanted their schools to be strong in their communities. I think being able to come back with that information will allow us to actually focus on how do we solve those problems once we know these are the problems that people want to have solved.
In recent years, fewer and fewer Wyomingites are choosing to be Democrats. From July 2020 to July 2025, the Wyoming Democratic Party lost about 10,000 registered voters. As minority floor leader in the legislature, how do those numbers influence your lawmaking strategy?
Party registration is a bad metric because our party system is set up to be register for the party that you think that you can make the most difference in a primary election in. And I think that's a false way to actually reflect the values of what people want out of their society. And like I said, I think it's a terrible system where we have to reflect national party politics regardless. My focus is, regardless of who's in what party, whether you're an independent, you're a Republican, you're a registered Libertarian, Democrat, whatever, how do we solve the problems in your community? And we can't do that without first identifying what are the issues in your community that you want worked on.
But with only 8 members in the legislature, what does that say about voters' appetite for the policies you and your Democratic colleagues are pushing?
Like I said, I think it's more of a reflection of both the primary system we have as well as the reflection that we have to match national party politics. And so I think that there's appetite for the policies because I hear them when I go to every community that we're going to. And I also want to make sure that as Democrats in our caucus, that we're going to be listening to what people on the ground want to work on, regardless of what party they are. So I kind of want to throw all that party stuff out the window if we really could. Unfortunately, it's a system that we live in, but I think that I'm trying to cross those barriers as much as possible.
Part two to that last question is, to be considered a major political party in Wyoming, your candidates for either governor, secretary of state, or U.S. House representative need to get to at least 10% of the total votes cast in the most recent general election. Are you and the party worried that you may dip below that threshold?
I'm not worried about that at all. Not something that I focus on.
Do you have any concerns heading into the budget session about what people are starting to say to you about what may happen to the state budget?
I have a lot of concerns. I think that we have a lot of problems that haven't even been tackled in these interim committees, right? Like I said, we're tackling problems that no one has told me that they thought were problems in our community meetings. We have a lot of federal funding that's going to disappear, not only to our state budget, but to local community county budgets and municipal budgets. And I think that we're going to be on track to not solving the problems that we're hearing around the state, but actually making those problems worse.
What's one thing that folks have told you at these town halls that has been surprising to you or that maybe you didn't see coming?
You know, it's been interesting that we've heard a couple of grumblings in different communities over different sort of things, right? So the nuclear topic has come up. I think that makes sense, especially for Casper. Data centers have come up. People are worried about water usage. You know, I think I was a little surprised at thinking how much people are paying attention about water, but it is one of our most precious resources, and we've been in an extended drought for a long, long time, so trying to figure out how we solve those water issues, especially if we bring in new businesses and you want to make sure they are good on their water usage. But I think the big ones have all been things that have gotten worse over time, right? So our housing problem, making sure that we have good health care coverage across the state, making sure that we have strong jobs across the state. But we keep seeing young people leave in bigger and bigger droves every year.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Representative Yin.
Anytime.
That was a conversation between Jackson Representative Mike Yin, a Democrat, and state government reporter Chris Clements. In the coming weeks, Democrats will hold more listening sessions in Sheridan as well as Park and Bighorn counties. A town in southwestern Wyoming is finding new ways to remember a dark period of its history. As Jackson Hole Community Radio's Jenna McMurtry reports, recent commemoration events in Rock Springs shed light on a 19th century massacre of Chinese immigrant workers.
Over Labor Day weekend, several hundred people gathered in the center of Rock Springs, where Chinatown used to be, for the unveiling and dedication of a new statue. At over 7 feet tall, bronze casting depicts a distraught Chinese coal miner. He's emerging from the ruins of his burned home with the torn remnants of a traditional dragon flag. Shattered rice bowls and broken lanterns lie at his feet.
Today is an important milestone in how we all think, feel, and understand the events of that dark time. Today, we will honor the lives lost.
Labor disputes in the coal mines 140 years ago fanned the flames that led a white mob to burn down and loot the Rock Springs Chinatown. The mob killed 28 Chinese and injured another 14, making it one of the deadliest incidents of anti-Chinese violence in U.S. history.
So today we honor the victims of these horrific crimes and injustice 140 years ago.
Liu Song Sun, Liu Dai Fa, Liu Long Hong.
The coal miner in the statue represents the hundreds of survivors who fled to the nearest Chinatown for safety, more than 100 miles away in Evanston. Rock Springs Mayor Max Mickelson is one of many local attendees with generational ties to Rock Springs. His ancestors were European immigrants that worked in the mines alongside the Chinese at a time when the town drew workers from all over the world. In front of the statue, he delivers a proclamation.
Whereas on September 2nd, 1885, racial and financial tensions among the workers in the No. 6 mine in Rock Springs boiled over into a violent riot that would forever mark our community.
Since inauguration, the second Trump administration has ramped up pressure on federally funded historical institutions, such as the Smithsonian and the national parks, urging them to present history that paints the country, especially its violent past, in a more positive light. In Rock Springs, the town's acknowledgement of its past stands in contrast. The week-long commemoration brings traditional Chinese blessings, lion dances, lectures, and cooking demos. It's both a memorial and a celebration of the town's Chinese past and present. Today, Mayor Mickelson says migrants are again targets.
As someone who is a descendant of immigrants, I find it very frustrating that as a country we have decided to take an anti-immigrant stance.
He's referencing the ongoing federal crackdown on immigrants. It's also local, with Sweetwater County, home to Rock Springs, leading some of the country's most robust police partnerships with Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Lots of friends who, you know, came to America and are U.S. citizens when they were 14, 15, and they love this country ever bit as much.
As a self-described old-school Republican, Mickelson often feels alone critiquing the current immigration system. He's seen his party steer farther away, with the state house becoming the country's first majority far-right Freedom Caucus. The mayor thinks there are more important issues to focus on.
In a community on I-80 that has fairly substantial issues with, you know, drug trafficking, human trafficking, I think we have real problem areas where those resources would be better put than tracking down somebody who is here working, putting up stucco.
Behind the new statue, an archaeological dig is underway. Minutes after the ceremony, local and visiting scholars are already back in the ground, searching for artifacts from the burned-down Chinatown. Part of their work aims to bring awareness to the violence against immigrants, to ensure it never happens again. Jenna McMurtry, KHOL News.
Up next, there's new housing in Jackson, but it's missing what some say is a crucial amenity. Stick with us to find out what. This is Open Spaces.
Thank you. Want to do more than just listen to Wyoming Public Radio? You can help us through our new volunteer platform. We're looking for a few folks to pick up court documents, take photos, and promote local events. Sign up with the volunteer button at the top of our website. We depend on you as much as you rely on us.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Housing for Jackson's working class almost always comes with some sort of sacrifice. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Sophia Boyd-Flegel reports on how a new housing project exemplifies the trade-off a lot of renters are finding themselves considering, specifically in the kitchen.
Take Alana Alfrey. She's worked several different jobs in Jackson for over a decade.
I was working in restaurants for most of the time and then switched into like the property management side of hospitality.
At 25, she started renting a cabin off the back of a main house. She had pretty reasonable rent, but
there was no oven, and that was, you know, for just about 8 years. So
four people interviewed for the story talked about life without ovens. One ate mostly raw and takeout food in an employee-subsidized hotel room she rented for $700 a month. Two ate mostly from restaurants they worked in.
You know, like Thanksgiving comes up or cookouts with friends for football season, and suddenly I'm like, all these things that I would usually take like one pan and shove it in the oven, I had to think of another way to make it, or like show up at other people's houses hours earlier, go like to a friend's house and borrow their oven.
Soon, around 100 more people will join the No Oven Club. All will be employed somewhere in Teton County.
So these are all units that have been remodeled, redone, ready to go. I'll show you a vacant one. This is a one bedroom.
Sadik Darwich walks down a carpeted hallway lined with hotel-style art into a room with big windows and new hardwood floors. He's about halfway done renovating a former assisted living facility with 57 rooms just south of town.
Two burner cooktop, countertop, oven, perfect for, you know, one or two people or three people, late night pizza or chicken wings or, you know, maybe some brownies or whatever you want to do.
He bought Legacy Lodge in 2021 with his brother after the business went under during the COVID-19 pandemic. Studios include a two burner cooktop and a toaster oven on each counter. Base rent is $2,350, but no conventional ovens. That left some like Alfrey guessing.
I just am confused why they didn't bother putting them in. If they're, you know, already doing the construction and the space is there, why would you not just put the oven in?
For Darwich, the decision comes down to getting local workers in fast and keeping prices down. He's seen online criticism that the rent is too high, but he thinks the cost is still fair, especially if employees buy leases and subsidize. A common practice in Jackson.
We looked at the entire market and we came down 20% below the average of the entire market. And when we looked at that, at the first iteration, they said that. I said, no, they need to be lower.
In a market as tight as this, Legacy Lodge is pretty unique. For one, the owners voluntarily restricted that only local workers live there. They also agreed to a county rule that gives first pick to critical service providers like firefighters and nurses. Then there's the fact that it's saving taxpayers millions. A new two-bedroom, 1,000-square-foot rental cost just shy of $800,000 to construct in Jackson, according to a 2023 housing study, with about a third of that coming from taxpayers if it's subsidized. Claire Stumpf runs the housing advocacy group Shelter JH. She gets why people are upset about the lack of ovens. But at the same time,
these units meet the livability standards that are imposed by our housing department.
A big commercial kitchen available for rent downstairs is a plus, she says, and the rents are below market. A new nearby apartment complex is renting studios starting at $3,000 a month. Stumpf knows a lot of people who would think that these units are a big step up. Before the Darwiches converted them into housing, they'd been sitting empty for about 4 years.
There are people living in unsafe situations. There are people living in overcrowded situations. There are folks living in their vehicles. And there are folks, of course, who are forced to leave the valley because they don't have other options.
Stumpf and Darwich say they've seen plenty of interest in the rooms, which range from studios to two bedrooms. It shows promise as a community hub, with some rooms that could be reworked as a gym or a salon. There's even a sauna.
The other ideas I have for some of the other sort of spaces here are setting up a workspace where somebody could tune a bike or tune or wax a pair of skis.
This communal living idea is a trend in bigger cities where denser housing is more of the norm, and it's becoming more common here. About 30 minutes drive away in Victor, Idaho, the Larkspurs dorm-style one-bedrooms start at $1,500 a month, and they come with ovens. Sophia Boyd-Fliegel, KHOL News.
Universities across the country tend to be at the forefront of research for artificial intelligence. The University of Wyoming is no exception, but how students and professors use it in the lab is actually very different from in the classroom. A reporter for the Branding Iron student paper at UW investigated how AI is changing learning, grades, and career readiness. He says the human element is disappearing. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger talked with fourth-year student Vin Meester in the student union.
Do you mind if I call you Vin?
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining me, Vin. So 2 weeks ago, you said, right?
Yes.
You wrote this really eye-opening article for the university newspaper, The Branding Iron. The title is The Rise of AI in UW Classrooms, From Frightening Cheating Tool to Class Grading Systems. You talk about how AI went from a controversial issue for universities to so widely used among students that eventually teachers started using it as well. So let's start there. What drove you to explore AI and its current use on campus?
Yeah, so last year, just serving in so many capacities on campus, I had a wide variety of students coming to me about academic policies regarding cheating. Many students on campus were being accused of cheating, using ChatGPT, using AI, and it was under fire. You had professors everywhere accusing students of using these tools to essentially coast their way through classes. And now, this year, the very first thing I saw when I opened up my online classes is that multiple of my professors aren't just using AI tools as a teaching method, they're quite literally using AI tools to grade things like discussions and annotation comments, to the point where I have a class where my teacher doesn't grade anything by hand. It is all done by an AI tool called Perusal.
And so this was, you saw AI being used improperly in the academic environment. And so this article was kind of your way of taking action and bringing light to that?
Absolutely, yeah. It's the hypocritical idea of, we had so many students who were in danger last year of getting terrible grades, of even facing academic probation for cheating, and now in just a year's span, faculty with virtually no forewarning are allowed to use AI to grade students with virtually no accountability. And so essentially students aren't being held to the same standard that faculty are in our current system.
I think for a lot of our listeners, they understand that AI is being used in a university environment, but maybe they don't fully understand how and to what degree. So starting with students, can you explain, just, you know, for the average listener, how today's university student might use AI to cheat or skip the academic process?
Absolutely. The most glaring example is most quizzes online through our system Canvas. You can quite literally just copy and paste those questions into something like ChatGPT, into an AI system, and it will generate all of the multiple choice answers. You can take a quiz that you should have studied for and read 200 pages of a textbook, and you can Google it, and within seconds you can have the entire thing done. In the same vein, you could take 4 different reading prompts that you were supposed to read in a textbook, tell ChatGPT what they are, and it will generate an entire summary of that for you that you can just word for word type into a discussion post, type into an essay prompt, type into a review, to the point where students are spending maybe 5 minutes because they have these AI tools to essentially just coast their way through all the content.
And you also mentioned a program that teachers were using. What was it called?
It's called Perusal.
Can you talk about that a little bit as well?
Yeah, so the main thing Perusal is used for is, within textbooks, it's an interactive reader. It does things like track how long students are looking at each page to see if they're actually reading the content. What it also does is it can grade the quality and quantity of annotations. So rather than having open discussion posts, professors are now having students annotate each other's comments on the textbook, and then the Perusal system is grading the quality of those questions, comments, and replies to other students, with no teacher involvement whatsoever.
I want to bring in one more party here. You didn't directly mention them in the article, but they're a part of this equation nonetheless. Is the university administration, do they have a position on this? Are they telling students and teachers, like, you know, wholesale, go in, all in on AI? Are they saying be cautious? Are they putting up very specific rules? What's the administration's position on all this?
The administration's position, from what I've understood, and I've been deeply entrenched in that community at UW for a long time, has always been, we're on the forefront of innovation here. We are the School of Computing. We are at the forefront of a lot of things involving AI, and so we should be teaching our faculty and students to use it as a learning tool. However, in allowing that freedom to use it as a learning tool, there's been virtually no safeguards against abusing that tool.
Can you give me a definition of, like, what the line is between, like, cheating and using AI as a tool?
Yeah, it's, can I still engage with the course content? Can I do the course content without the AI after using it as something like a Quizlet? I can take those quizzes, but then after that, I can do that quiz in class without that help. I can use it to summarize a source, but then after summarizing that source, I know how to present those ideas and engage with my classmates. It's the ability to use it to supplement what you're doing, not to just replace you doing the work.
And I'm curious if you kind of already talked about this, but can you build a little bit more in your mind what a University of Wyoming looks like that is handling AI maybe a little bit better on the from the perspective of teachers or students? What does it look like in your mind?
Absolutely. It's the human touch, right? I have two different professors who both use AI tools to a degree, but they have that human impact. They use something like Perusal, where it tracks your annotations and it does things like tell you how long students are spending on each part of the course, but at the same time, they're manually grading those discussion comments. They're responding to their students. I have another professor who, he allows us to use things like ChatGPT to summarize written sources. He encourages it. He doesn't think that there's a lot of value to reading word by word a bunch of textbook pages. But at the same time, we discuss that content in class. We discuss the deeper meanings. We discuss the bigger ideas. And so it's really being able to incorporate that student experience and that human experience while also teaching your students that AI can make your work and research more efficient.
Do you think that anybody who chooses to not fully engage with AI or to try and retain as much of that human element as possible is going to be weaker in a market a couple of years from now?
Absolutely. Its ability to process information and data at such a fast rate surpasses anybody's ability in a job market right now. And if you can't harness that, you're going to be behind people who learn how.
So choosing between humanity and market viability?
Exactly. You have to be able to combine the two. You have to be able to present that information, but also know that ChatGPT is better at finding that information than you are.
You have an exciting job market to look forward to there. So thank you for your time, Vin.
Absolutely.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger speaking with student reporter Vin Meester about AI use in UW classrooms. The university updated its student academic dishonesty regulations in 2023, banning student use of AI applications unless expressly permitted by the instructor. UW doesn't currently regulate faculty use of AI. The university's AI committee is trying to catalog tools instructors may be using that have automatic integration of AI in them. Many people have passed through Lander and spent time in the Wind River Mountains because of Knowles. The Outdoor Leadership School is turning 60. That's up next on Open Spaces.
The Wyoming Public Radio app delivers great music 24/7. Stream Wyoming Sounds, Jazz Wyoming, and Classical Wyoming. Download the Wyoming Public Radio app at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kodalska. The National Outdoor Leadership School, also known as Knowles, got its start outside Lander in 1965. Students in wool army surplus clothes trekked into the Wind River Mountains with heavy external frame backpacks to learn how to survive and thrive in the backcountry. Since then, the school has taken students on wilderness expeditions around the world, Knowles will celebrate its 60th birthday with a reunion in Lander later this month. That will include talks from well-known climber Alex Honnold and NASA astronaut John Grunsfeld. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman, a former Knowles instructor herself, talked with President Sandy Calhoun about the school's successes and challenges since 1965 and what's on the horizon.
It's hard to believe that a little school founded in Sinks Canyon has grown to become a $40 million business, a nonprofit education school that has educated thousands and thousands of students. We're so proud of our Wilderness Medicine, which is celebrating its 35th anniversary this year. They educated over 20,000 students last year, teaching them skills where they can step up in an emergency. But we're also proud of like the training that we've done for our students around the world to both promote their ability to lead and step up in their communities at home after they've been trained, but also to like be comfortable in the wilderness. We're incredibly proud of our partnerships with folks like NASA, taking astronauts who go to space out on Knowles expeditions, naval midshipmen, Google executives. The breadth of students that Knowles has served is super exciting, and we're proud of that.
What are some challenges you would point to from the last 60 years?
I'm so glad you said that, because we do have them. The reality is the world has changed so much. There was a time when Knowles and it was really Outward Bound just competed against each other in terms of trying to secure students. But as we all know, the world has radically changed in terms of opportunities that our students can choose from. So the challenge for Knowles right now is about enrollment and making sure that we can take our message and make Knowles the course of choice when they're choosing to do a backcountry expedition or a wilderness medicine course. So we have a lot of competition from your cell phone to your students' athletic choices. You know, we're one of many, many choices.
What drew you to Knowles in the first place, and what kind of sparks excitement for you about Knowles as a school?
I took my Knowles course in 1986. I was a kid from Baltimore, Maryland, and it absolutely changed the trajectory of my life. It was really hard. Hard for me, it was a 30-day Wind River mountaineering course. It was rainy and wet that summer. I think I lost a bunch of weight. It was hard, but it gave me the foundation of outdoor skills and experience that has followed me throughout my entire life. And what gets me excited about Knowles, I love our students. I love our instructors. They're humble, they're competent, they're kind, and they're the kind of people that we want educating students. Because I'll just say this, the most important thing I can say about Knowles, the world is a divisive place right now. I don't think anybody will argue about that. I believe that Knowles students are needed more in the world now than ever before. People who can have disagreement and actually work their way through it. And they learn those skills when you're out in a remote and austere environment. You learn how to cooperate and work together as part of a team. And that's what Knowles does so, so well.
How would you say Knowles has impacted Wyoming and Lander specifically?
I'll tease some exciting news for you that we are going to release at the 60th reunion, but we commissioned a report on the economic impact that Knowles has had on Fremont County and the state of Wyoming. The economic impact that we have brought to bear on the state of Wyoming on an annual basis is really larger than I think anyone can imagine. And we're excited to share that because it's done independently. It wasn't like us, you know, self-promotion. We had a third party come in and do the analysis for us. So the other thing I would just say is that one of the less tangible pieces of Knowles is that when students come to Knowles and they come to Lander and they come to the Rockies and they come to Wyoming, so often it's the beginning of a lifetime relationship with the state. They come back over many, many decades, not just from domestic United States, but from around the world. That includes instructors who come from all corners of the planet, from Brazil and Chile and India to East Africa. We're bringing so many people to the state of Wyoming. And those actually are economic impacts that are less tangible than the report.
Earlier, you spoke to some of the challenges in terms of student enrollment and competing with cell phones and sports. From your perspective, like, how is Knowles looking in terms of long-term health as a business?
I am an optimist at heart. I think the word that I'll be using a lot when we gather for the 60th is momentum. Knowles has an extraordinary amount of momentum right now. We're working on a lot of strategic partnerships with colleges, universities, secondary schools. We're developing new programs. We're very excited, for example, about a new semester program called the Knowles Global Healthcare Semester, where you take an EMT course in Lander and then go off either to India or East Africa to practice medicine and to learn, to practice those EMT skills and also to take an expedition. So we're developing new products. We're innovating. Knowles has been operating in the red for several years, and we've greatly reduced that year over year over year. And in addition, have had record fundraising. So in combination, all of those things make me incredibly optimistic.
I'm curious if Knowles is experiencing any impact or concern about sort of how the state of the federal budget is going to impact Knowles.
Fortunately for us, Knowles does not rely on federal dollars to operate. We're privately funded, we're a nonprofit, we're an educational organization. Where the impact is really felt, I believe, is in cuts to the national parks and cuts in national forest areas and places where like trails haven't been cleared, or there are fewer rangers on patrol. We feel those impacts directly, and we're trying to do our best to support the community by, for example, going off and doing where we operate, where we're on trails. We've sent some crews in to try to help clear those trails. So the place where I see the biggest challenge is just slightly outside of our direct business at a direct education school and in what's happening in the wilderness classrooms where we operate. And we are worried about that, and we're focused on it in a big way.
What are some of your hopes for the next 60 years of Knowles?
Giant focus of ours is to get out to colleges and universities and community schools and secondary schools, high schools, and tell the Knowles story and make them know that we have financial aid available, that we have courses for all ages, to get the Knowles story in a wider community. That's one of my top priorities. I want to make sure that I leave Knowles in an incredibly healthy position. You know, we have still work to do. I will not be happy or satisfied until we have a fully balanced budget and that Knowles is strong in that way. And we're close. We're very close. And we have lots of resources to get it done. The last thing I'll just say is that I just think that the Knowles experience transforms lives in so many different ways. And the vision of our school is to elevate the leader in everyone. And what we hope is that you come back from a Knowles course and you take your leadership skills wherever you want to. It might be in your synagogue. It might be in your church. It might be in your school or in your family or in your company. You can lead in so many different ways. And that's, I think, the fundamental thing that we do at Knowles and that I would like to make sure we continue doing for the next 60 years.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman talking with Knowles President Sandy Calhoun as the school turns 60. Stick with us. Soon we'll hear about a Wyoming cowboy who won the nation's top folk and traditional arts award. This is Open Spaces.
Hey there, this is Kelly Trujillo. Join me Saturday mornings for Buffalo Grass, 11 to 1, on listener-supported Wyoming Public Radio. You'll hear the best in bluegrass music, old and new, plus Americana, folk, Western, and even a little bit of Celtic. That's Buffalo Grass, Saturdays at 11 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Teton County is home to the largest Latino population in the state, about 30% on the high end. That's why people will tell you there's a quinceañera every week of the summer. Some say the coming-of-age celebration for Latina 15-year-old girls is waning in popularity in this generation, but not in Jackson. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Philpella Ankeny reports from a ballroom on one girl's big birthday blowout.
This Jackson quinceañera is all about the Sanchez family. Diego, Berta, Edison, and most importantly, Madeline. The 15-year-old is minutes from beginning the biggest celebration of her young life. She's spent years thinking about it, months rehearsing, and just the day before, the shy 15-year-old says she's felt it all.
I would say it has been like some bumps. Like I've been nervous, but then I'm excited, but then I'm nervous and I'm excited.
But you won't hear much from the Sanchezes tonight. They're busy. Diego, Madeline's father, is greeting hundreds of friends and family at tables that fill the room. He's been planning the party for over a year. Today, he's taking phone call after phone call from cousins and caterers inside and out of the Jackson Hole Conference Center.
Can you give me 5 minutes?
Of course. Yeah, please, do your thing.
Berta is also waving hellos while running chairs from the dining area to the ballroom through the hallway where her daughter is pacing in a red dress that's big enough to fill a parking space, having her lip gloss reapplied. 11-year-old Edison is nearby. He's busy after visiting the 20-foot-long candy buffet.
Atención, atención. El momento más esperado ha llegado.
So with no open seats left, the last of over 100 guests stand shoulder to shoulder along the walls. Madeline and her chambleanes, teen boys serving in her dance ensemble, are introduced one by one at a near ear-bleeding decibel.
Con un fuerte aplauso, recibamos a sus chambelanes, Edison Sánchez.
And quickly, they're into their first dance as lights shoot across the foggy room and sparks fly into the air behind them. Before the night ends, there will be three more choreographed routines. The teens have spent months rehearsing the swirls to the slow serenades, to the punchy jerks of the more spicy. These dances and the entire ceremony is steeped in tradition. Between each dance are symbolic displays of the transition into womanhood. Like Madeline's tennis shoes being removed in place of heels, she'll receive a doll from her knee-high niece, signifying her last toy. She'll also work up the courage to lead a toast to everyone who helped tonight, from music and decorations to cake, drinks, and plates of food. Jacksonites Andrea Bulanos and Martha Herrera are part of that toast. The close family friends put up decorations until midnight the night before. Bulanos says as a little girl, she dreamed of a quince. Most do.
The gown, the cake, the dance, and all of that.
But she never had one. Neither did Herrera, each for their own reasons. It's something the two say is becoming more and more common in Latin culture. Instead of an extravagant party, teens are requesting that money be spent on a new car or an expensive trip.
What I've noticed here in Jackson specifically is that the families that raise their kids in here, they're sticking up to those traditions. Because if you go to Mexico right now, it's very rare that you find a party like this.
For Herrera, the parties are like a reunion.
I love to be here in this, like, Latino parties because we miss our country, you know? And see this, at least for me, it's like a... I feel like my family and my country, like... much closer to me.
Diego's had a little break from phone calls to enjoy the festivities. He steps on and off the dance floor and says, though tired, he's happy.
And my daughter, my wife, my son, everybody's so happy.
The night has been a success. Madeline's still dancing.
She's my goal. She's my princess forever. She's really good at it. And she's really good students, really good persons. I love my daughter.
He's lived in Jackson since his daughter was born 15 years ago, though tonight's focus is on her. The party is a display of a family, community, and life he describes as beautiful. Dante Fippola Inkney, KHOL News.
An artist based in Lovell is receiving the nation's highest award in folk and traditional arts next week. Ernie Marsh is the second bit and spur maker to receive a National Heritage Fellowship in the 43-year history of the National Endowment for the Arts Program. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats spoke with Josh Chrysler, folklorist at the Wyoming Arts Council, who nominated Marsh for the award.
Before we talk about Ernie, I want to talk a little bit about you and your role as a folklorist. some people might not know that Wyoming has a folklorist, and I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about your role and what you do.
So as a folklorist, I get to spend a lot of time talking to and visiting and getting to know people who practice these folk and traditional arts. A lot of times I'll get to do record ethnographic oral history interviews with people to learn more about the work they do, learn about the history of their tradition. And those interviews and the photographs I take, they go into the Wyoming Folklife Collection at the American Heritage Center, which is a collection of interviews and materials that sort of tell the story of folk and traditional arts in Wyoming. And then I get to work with the artists and find ways to help support them in their work practicing their traditional art form.
And can you tell us a little bit about what are the folk and traditional arts in Wyoming? What kinds of arts are people pursuing here in Wyoming?
Folk and traditional arts are usually like pretty deeply rooted in community. They're really grassroots art forms. They grow out of cultural communities that are in the state. And so a big one is cowboy gear making, things like saddle making, rawhide braiding, bit and spur making, things that are grow out of the everyday experience of working on the ranch, moving cattle, these types of things. They're utilitarian art forms. They're art forms that are made to be used.
Yeah, so Ernie Marsh, he's a silversmith and a bit and spur maker. Can you share a brief bio of Ernie? How did he become one of the leading cowboy artists of today?
Ernie Marsh was born in California in 1962, but he primarily grew up in Washington State. He spent a lot of his youth there as a bull rider, an amateur, a professional rodeo, and, you know, spent time working as a ranch hand in southeastern Washington. And that's when he really became interested in becoming a bit and spur maker. And at that time, there was really just one person who was offering basically like a bit and spur making school. And his name was Elmer Miller, and he was out of Nampa, Idaho. And Ernie went and studied under Elmer and really became well known for the beautiful work that he'd produce. He moved around to different places in the rural West there in eastern Oregon, and eventually out to Wyoming, where he now lives outside of Lovell. He's got a shop there and works with his wife, Teresa, but he also constantly having students at his shop. And over time, he just became very well known and became one of the best bit and spur makers and silversmiths in the country.
So Josh, before the interview, you shared some photos of Ernie's work. And one of the pieces is a bridle bit that Ernie made in 2016. And I'm wondering if you can describe it for us.
The bit that we're looking at here, it's pretty representative of Ernie's work. It's a beautiful bit, and the key feature here is it has a butterfly design sculpted into the steel itself. If you're looking at the bit on each cheek piece, on one edge of the cheek piece, there's you can see a butterfly's body and the butterfly's head, and you can see its eyes. And then spreading from that end of the cheek piece up to the other end are the butterfly's wings. And it's just a cool way to do it. It's subtly put in there that you could glance at the bit and not immediately recognize representation of the butterfly. But if you look at it for more than a couple of seconds, you'll see it in there. And so it's pretty representative of the type of stuff Ernie does. It's just beautiful. Ernie likes to do these representations of animals, of nature. He's had pieces with lizards in them, eagles. It's just pretty cool.
The Wyoming Arts Council has a folk and traditional arts mentorship program, and that's where a master artist teaches an up-and-coming artist, and there's funds that support that, and they get to meet a bunch of different times and learn from each other. And it looks like you're able to fund next year's cohort of mentors and mentees. There's some uncertainty over the federal budget and whether or not funds will be able to continue for this. And I'm wondering if this were to not continue, what would be lost?
I think it's important to keep these kinds of opportunities available for folks to pass on knowledge to others from their community who are eager to learn. These art forms are really representative of what Wyoming is, who Wyomingites are. I think a lot of Ernie's works really shows the connection to ranching and cowboy culture that I think is really important for Wyoming. And I think that these traditional art forms, they just really help keep us grounded as a culture and help us resist that temptation to move into everything mass produced, everything AI generated, and polar opposition to some of those things. And I think that the culture here in Wyoming really values that mastery of skill that goes into a traditional art form like that Ernie puts into his bits and his spurs.
How big of a deal is it that an artist based in Wyoming won the National Endowment for the Arts National Heritage Fellowship? Does this happen very often?
No, this is a big deal, and I think it really shows how deserving Ernie is of this recognition. The National Heritage Fellowship is the highest honor for folk and traditional arts given by our United States government, and it's the type of thing that really goes to the best of the best, the most representative of the traditions that they practice. So this is a really big deal, and Ernie is very deserving of it.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats speaking with Josh Kreisler about Ernie Marsh, who received the nation's highest award in folk and traditional arts. Marsh will be honored at the National Heritage Fellowship's award ceremony at the Library of Congress this coming Wednesday. A link for the stream is on our website. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms, which include Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, X, and Blue Sky. A big thanks to Ivy Engel, this episode's audio producer and digital producer, and to Cody Hume, our social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.